Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
As our medical breakthroughs get more and more advanced, our need for ethics becomes more and more important. Don't you agree? I mean, just some of the questions that you have to face these days, like parents, and whether parents should select the embryo that will produce a child that provides the necessary blood transfusion for their sick firstborn. The technology is there. The decision you make on them rests on the ethics that you choose. How about the sex selection of your child? You can do that now. How about embryonic stem cell therapy? We can do that now. What about therapeutic cloning of embryos? We can do that now. Do we do them or not? Comes down to your ethics. Then there's the raft of non-technology related medical dilemmas. Like, when do you turn the life support system off? What about euthanasia? What about refusing food, like the recent case of Christian Rossiter in Western Australia? Well, those questions are going to be explored over the next few moments with Dr. John Wyatt. He's Professor of Ethics and Perinatology at University College London. His focus is on the ethics of medical technologies and medical practice, and his book, Matters of Life and Death, is considered something of a thought leader in the field. He explores these dilemmas from a Christian faith position, so I'm very glad to have John Wyatt with us in the studio. John, welcome to Open House.
Thanks very much.
And welcome to Australia too.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're just getting over the jet lag right
yes,
about
I
now,
am.
Aren't you?
Slightly jet lag, but very glad to be here.
You're presenting a series of talks at this week's New College Lectures in Sydney, which I want to give the details of in a few moments' time. But how have you seen the bioethical landscape, if I might put it that way, change over the years that you've actually been in the medical field?
Well, it is an incredibly rapidly changing field. I've been working as a doctor in London for 25 years, and in that time, dramatic changes as new techniques, some of the ones you've mentioned and many others in my own field, caring for newborn babies, and a great diversity of opinions, so that there's no longer a common agreed fundamental views in society. We are in what's often called a pluralistic society. People are coming from different places, and these issues go right to the very heart of what it means to be a human being. Mm. How do I understand my own identity? How do I understand the identity of those around them? So it's an exciting, challenging, difficult, frustrating area to be part of.
I bet it is. Because, yeah, when we start talking about ethics, it does come down to whose ethics. And when we live in a pluralistic society, which the UK does, Australia does, the US does, other Western countries do, how do you make those decisions when there is a variety of ethical systems at play? That must be incredibly difficult for somebody like yourself in your area.
Well, it's a real challenge, and it's a matter of very ongoing debate among politicians, opinion formers, academics, and practical clinicians. There is an argument that is saying we shouldn't allow religious believers, from people coming from a faith position, actually to take part, or at least to introduce their religious views into the public debate. Mm. The argument goes that if you're going to involve in the public debate, then you've got to assume secular ground rules. You've got to take on a mask of secular neutrality. Perhaps not surprisingly, I very strongly disagree with that. I think that it's much more honest for us all to say that we are coming from different faith positions, and somebody who claims to be an atheist, a materialist, and so on, has also got a faith position. They have their own personal beliefs, commitments, and I think it's much more honest, rather than to pretend to some kind of objective neutrality, which really doesn't exist, mm-hmm. for us to examine the places we're coming from and try and discuss, can we find common ground? There's a lot of common ground we can find, as well as recognising that there are going to be core issues in which we fundamentally differ.
Yes. You're going to present a case for the Judeo-Christian ethic. Now, to get there, I want to contrast it with the views of Peter Singer, Princeton University's Peter Singer, who's come to prominence as, I guess, probably one of the more radical ethicists about life and death matters in many ways, isn't he?
Well, he's incredibly influential. He's probably the most influential modern philosopher working in this area. And part of his attraction is that he's extremely radical, but he's also very logical. He takes fundamental principles and then follows them through, sometimes to quite startling and extreme conclusions. Mm. He's amazingly influential in philosophy departments and even high schools. I mean, this is now standard stuff, philosophy 101, very basic high school courses on bioethics and so on. I mean, his ideas are frequently discussed, and students write long essays on them.
Okay, which is probably why we should be contrasting, I guess, with those kinds of ideas since they're becoming so influential. John White is with us on Open House, a professor of ethics and perinatology at University College London, author of Matters of Life and Death. And we're talking about the Christian ethic when it comes to some of those big ethical dilemmas when it comes to medical matters. First of all, let's explore Peter Singer's Five Commandments. He's kind of replaced the Ten Commandments in many ways with his own Five Commandments. I want to give you the commandment. You can just fill it out a little bit, and then I'll get your own seven responses that you've actually got outlined in your book in just a minute. Number one, Peter Singer says, instead of treating all human life as equal, recognize that the worth of human life varies. What does he mean by that?
Well, his fundamental idea is that although we traditionally have said that all human life is valuable, Singer says this is obviously rubbish, that some human lives are much more valuable than others. And what he particularly values is their ability to choose. He says that the most valuable thing about being human is our ability to choose our own direction. It's what philosophers call autonomy. And the people, the humans, the beings who are able to choose and direct their own identity and to choose their own pleasurable experiences, these are the lives that are really worthwhile. So then there are going to be other human beings who, for whatever reason, are less able to choose. For instance, they've got learning difficulties, they've got brain damage, they've got diseases such as Alzheimer's disease or some other kind of problems. And those human lives are going to be less valuable than those who are completely healthy and able to choose. And then he's going to say there are some human beings who really have very limited lives at all. For instance, the unborn baby, the fetus, or somebody in a coma because of brain damage. They really have no ability to choose. So those lives really are very limited. And then he would say there are some lives that are actually so limited, so bad, so painful, that actually their lives have negative value. Those people would be better off dead than carrying on living, and actually we do them a service if we end their lives.
Commandment number two from Peter Singer is take responsibility for the consequences of your actions, and this kind of replaces the traditional prohibition against taking innocent life.
Singer's arguing that we have to think about the consequences of our actions. And this he belongs to the philosophy of utilitarianism. It's the idea that all of us, whatever actions we take, we are responsible to bring more pleasure, more happiness into the world compared to more sadness. And if any decision that I take, it's a morally good thing if it leads to more happiness, and it's a morally bad thing if it leads to more sadness. And so, for instance, to just relate it to me, working as a baby doctor, a paediatrician, if because of my action trying to save a baby's life, that in some way this baby goes on and has problems in their life and sadness, then it could well be that I've done a moral evil by actually saving that child's life. So he explicitly says, for instance, much better if the parents have got a disabled child for us to kill that baby and let, say, the parents go ahead and have another baby, because that baby's going to be healthy and that baby's going to bring much more happiness into the world than allowing a disabled child to live. So if what we hear about is just increasing the total amount of happiness in the world, then it's logically very sensible for us to bring one life to an end in order that another more healthy life can come in its place.
Number three, Peter Singer's third commandment, respect a person's desire to live or die.
Yeah, so then part of his idea is that it's about choice is the most important thing, and my ability to choose the direction of my own life. So therefore, if I value my life, then of course I must be protected and I must be allowed for my life to continue. But on the other hand, if I've come to the conclusion that my life is not worth living, if I'm feeling suicidal, then why on earth should we prevent people from committing suicide? This is completely irrational, says Singer. If someone's desire is to die, then we must respect that desire and we must assist them if they want help in dying. So he's an advocate of euthanasia, both for people who are actually volunteering, particularly for people who are volunteering, but also, of course, for those who he's decided on some grounds that their lives are not worth living.
Commandment number four from Peter Singer is bring children into the world only if wanted.
This sounds pretty straightforward, but of course he takes it on to say that parents really should have an absolute right to decide whether their children are wanted or not. And he's argued that because a newborn baby is not aware of its own existence and is therefore can't be said to be choosing, he actually argues that a newborn baby isn't really a human person. It's a human being, but it's not a person. A person is somebody who is able to care for themselves and understand and choose to carry on to exist. So he goes on to say, if parents have brought a child who is either unwanted or who is disabled or in some way not the child that they wanted, then parents should have the right to bring that child's life to an end. And he argues actually there's no real difference between contraception, which is stopping a life being formed, abortion, which is ending the life of an unborn baby, and infanticide, which is ending the life of a newborn baby. He says that morally these three actions are all equivalent. They're all preventing a person coming into the world.
And then his fifth commandment from Peter Singer is, we shouldn't discriminate on the basis of species. This is quite a unique one.
Singer has argued that if we say that human beings are special compared with other species, then we're being guilty of a sort of discrimination, which is similar to saying young people are better than old people, or white people are better than black people, or males are better than females. These kinds of discrimination we think are wrong, but it's equally wrong to say that human beings are better than chimpanzees. And he calls this speciesism. Why should discriminating on the basis of species, on the fact that we're human beings, why should this be morally acceptable? So he would argue that an adult chimpanzee has much more moral value, because an adult chimpanzee appears to know it exists and has many of the capacities to choose its own existence. He would say an adult chimpanzee has much more value, say, than a newborn baby. And he would extend it to other animals. He would say dolphins, elephants, cats, dogs, all of these beings have greater capacity to choose their own existence compared with a brain-damaged human being. And therefore, we should value their lives as being more valuable than those of a deformed or disabled human.
Professor John White is our guest on Open House. John White is a professor of ethics and perinatology at University College London, the author of Matters of Life and Death. We're talking about the Judeo-Christian ethic, which you can actually hold and think about when you're making ethical decisions when it comes to medical questions. We've outlined Peter Singer's controversial five commandments that are opposed to that. Now, John, you've got 7 points in response to Peter, which you outline in the book, which I thought were really interesting in terms of forming a Judeo-Christian ethic. I'll do the same thing. I'll give you your 7 points. You fill it out with a little bit of detail, and maybe even how it would actually relate to that disabled child, or you've been bringing some various illustrations as we've been going on in our conversation, and how it might actually relate in a practical level. Number one, you say, the Christian perspective on the sanctity of human life provides a holistic perspective of human identity. Sounds technical. Unwrap it for us in street-level language.
Christianity says human beings are not merely chimpanzees with an extra bit of brain. We're not merely randomly evolved, meaningless beings that have just come by random events. Christianity, at its heart, says human beings are unique on the planet because in some mysterious way we are godlike beings. We reflect the character and the identity of God. And therefore, what's special about being a human being is much bigger than what Singer is arguing. Singer is saying that the essential thing about a human being is the ability to choose. And if you can't choose, then in some way your humanity is degraded, it's lower. It seems to me that Christianity is saying, that's rubbish. Human beings are far more wonderful and mysterious than that. They are beings who have bodies, who have minds, who have a spiritual aspect, who have relationships, who live in community. But those beings are one. We are, this is the concept of being a holistic, but that every aspect of our life is integrated together. So God has made us as integrated beings who have physical, mental, spiritual, social, relational aspects. And all those aspects go to make up the mysterious wonder of what it means to be human beings. Human beings are wonderful beings, even, therefore, the profoundly disabled child, the person suffering from Alzheimer's disease, the learning disabled person. These are precious, unique, wonderful beings. And Christianity preserves the value because it says that each of these beings in some mysterious way is like God himself.
Okay, number two. The Christian view of humanity made in God's image provides a stability of human identity throughout the whole of life. Where are you going with that one, kind of throughout the whole of life?
Well, the interesting thing about, and one of the big problems with Singer's concepts, is that in his view, you're only a human person if you can choose, if your brain is working. So at the moment, he would say, I'm a human person because hopefully I'm a bit jet-lagged, but I'm able to choose, I'm able to decide on my life. But suppose as I walk out the studio, some great catastrophe, a big block falls on my head, all of a sudden I'm brain injured, I'm in a coma. Singer would say, now I'm not a person any longer because I don't have lost the ability to choose. John Wyatt is no longer a person. John Wyatt's life may be, in fact, of little value, says Singer. I'm now in a convalescent home somewhere, you know, in a Sydney hospital or somewhere. Gradually my brain recovers and I now come to a position where I'm actually sort of working out who I am, my memory's coming back. All of a sudden I'm a person,
You're a person again.
So my personhood, according to Singer, my fundamental identity depends on all these contingent, random events. Is my cortex working all right? Has it stopped functioning? You know, has the chemicals in my brain functioning? I'm vulnerable. Who am I? Am I the same person? Have I lost it? Has it come back again? Well, I think what Christianity says is that I am the same being that God called into existence. God knew me and loved me and called me into existence even when I was a tiny dot in my mother's womb. And he has known me and loved me through all the stages of my life. And whatever happens to me, even if that block falls on my head, even if I develop Alzheimer's disease, I will be the person that God knows and loves. So my identity is preserved throughout every stage of my human existence. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Christians believe that human existence, of course, goes on beyond the grave, that God has plans for us which go on even beyond the grave. So my core identity will never be lost or changed.
It's a completely different understanding of what is a human. That's the founding starting point, isn't it? Okay, number three that you give as a response. The Christian understanding of humanity promotes social cohesion and mutual respect.
Yeah, you see, a real problem with Singer's understanding is that basically we are all individuals doing our own thing. We bounce off one another, but I'm trying to look after my interests. You're trying to look after your interests. Everybody is doing their own thing, trying to maximize their choices, their preferences, their pleasures, minimize their pain. And therefore, potentially you're a threat to me because you might be diminishing my pleasure. You know. And certainly that view implies that when I come across somebody with Alzheimer's disease, when I come across a profoundly disabled child or whatever, I can't really respect them because they're no longer a person. They're just a sort of, they're still a human, but they're almost subhuman. They're subpersonal, and their lives no longer have much value. Whereas it seems to me the Christian view of society is that we're all locked together as part of a community. I'm locked together with my relationships, my parents, my children, my wife, my friends, my community. Mm-hmm. We're all different. Some of us have better brains than others. Some of us are able to choose. Some of us are disabled, dependent, and all the rest. But we're all equally valuable as unique people in God's image. And the strong have the duty to care for the weak. So far from this view that here's somebody who's disabled, then let's just get rid of them, their life's no longer valuable, the Christian view turns that on its head and says, no, here is somebody who's weak, then our duty is to reach out. So very interesting in the Bible, in the Old Testament, there were certain groups in society that were singled out. They were widows, orphans, and aliens or immigrants. And why were they singled out? Answer, because they were uniquely vulnerable. They didn't have somebody to stand on their side. And so God, the great God of the Old Testament, Yahweh, says, therefore, I am the defender of the defenseless, and you, my people, have got to be on their side too. So So it turns on its head, this understanding of society.
This is Open House Across the Nation. John White is helping us explore a Judeo-Christian ethic when it comes particularly to medical dilemmas, medical problems. What do you do? I mean, when do you turn off the support system? What about euthanasia? What about refusing food? What about save your children when you can choose the right embryo to create a child who will actually have the right blood type to save your firstborn child who's sick? I mean, all of those kinds of things that technology allows us to do, how do we make decisions based on them? We've been exploring Peter Singer's radical ethics, and now we're exploring the Christian ethic as to how we can, I guess, a foundation for making those kinds of decisions. Theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast. Okay, John, your fourth response to Peter Singer says this: the Christian understanding of the sanctity of human life provides the basis for a consistent legal framework to protect human beings from destruction. This is where kind of you were talking before, at the beginning of our conversation. How do you make ethical decisions in a pluralistic society?
Yeah, well, this is where the law comes in, because our laws in the UK and here in Australia as well are profoundly influenced by a Christian understanding of the preciousness of all human life, which goes back thousands of years, really, to the sort of the origins of Western society and the Christian influence in society. I've often reflected on the fact in UK law, I'm working in a baby intensive care unit in central London, sometimes with an incredibly pathetic, tiny little premature babies weighing not a pound in weight, struggling for life. In UK law, if I was to end the life of a brain damaged, tiny premature baby, I am guilty of exactly the same offence as if I walk down to 10 Downing Street and lob a grenade into the Cabinet Office and wipe out the Cabinet of the UK government.
And rightly so.
And if you step back and say that, that's bizarre. Why should we value the life of this pathetic little being equally to the life of the head of the government? This is... certainly in ancient Greece or Rome, this would have been seen as utterly bizarre and indefensible. We take it, yes, that's the way it should be, because of this fundamental concept that human life is precious wherever it comes. It's of special and it's of equal value. The life of the Prime Minister in some way is equal to the life of this pathetic little child. That is a Christian understanding. If we take Singer's understanding, how on earth do we find a legal framework which will actually work? It's interesting, as legal theoreticians have tried to develop laws which will allow euthanasia and will allow lives to be terminated in different circumstances along the sort of lives that along the lines that Peter Singer is advocating, it's almost impossible to find a legal framework which will allow the sort of things which Peter Singer wants to allow without opening the door to sort of rampant abuse of vulnerable human beings. So the Judeo-Christian framework, which underpins our current laws about life and death, about murder, homicide, and so on, it provides a consistent legal framework which is part of the glue which binds our society together.
I like this next one that you say: the Christian perspective on human life fits human intuitions about human relationships. This is beyond just the rational, beyond just the logical, particularly, say, the logic of Peter Singer, an ethicist like that, to actually say, no, there is some sort of fundamental feeling that we actually have when we hold that newborn child, even if they are disabled, that there is something in us that says, I don't want to let this child go.
Well, you know, this is my repeated experience as a paediatrician, discussing some of these very painful, difficult issues with parents where there are real, these are real issues, where there is a profoundly disabled or brain-injured child or a child who's very deformed, and we're trying to discuss what's the right thing to do, and is it right to switch off the machinery, is it right... And it's a common experience that you know, a more intellectual thinking academic parent would say, you know, in my mind, I can see that this is just a sort of biological accident, and rationally, I can see that this being really is of little value. But in my heart, this is my child. How could I not care for my child? How my heart reaches out to this being? So sometimes in our strange secular society, people's intuitions, their hearts, are more reliable than they're thinking.
Isn't that interesting? So I would suggest that, where does that come from? It comes from us being made in the image of God, a God who longs to hold and embrace and actually creates and loves.
Exactly. And there is a very interesting story, which is in the public domain, that Peter Singer's own mother had advanced Alzheimer's disease, and all of Peter Singer's logic or the philosophy that he's been defending for years would say the right thing to do would be to terminate her life. That would be the loving thing to do. But Peter Singer himself, in an interview, has said, I couldn't do it. She was still my mother. Yeah. I still loved her. Yes, it was irrational, and I accept my... I couldn't carry out my philosophy.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Interesting that even Peter Singer shows this divergence. He would see that as a weakness. He would say, you know, that's just because, you know, I haven't been fully able to live out my philosophy. Whereas perhaps I would see that as a strength, that he's still a human being made in God's image.
I would agree with you. Number six, your sixth kind of response to Peter Singer's ethics, the Christian view of humanity motivates sacrificial and empathic caring by professionals and lay carers.
Well, this is, of course, a crucial issue, because if you really accept Peter Singer's understanding of the value of human life and you're working as a health professional, then what's going to be your attitude when you meet this severely demented person with Alzheimer's disease, or where you're caring for a disabled child? One of the very distressing things, you know, I sometimes hear junior doctors talking in very contemptuous terms about disabled people. You know, they talk about it privately behind people's backs. But one of the terrible words that doctors sometimes use about elderly people is they describe them as, oh, it's just a bit of old crumble.
And
there's a sort of contemptuous attitude towards the elderly with multiple pathologies. You know, they don't count, really. They're just degenerating, the dribbly brigade, you know, those kind of words. Whereas the Christian understanding teaches us that even these most pathetic beings are wonderful beings, beings made in God's image, beings of unique value. And therefore, you know, I, as a Christian health professional, have sometimes thought that as I'm caring for this little baby struggling for life with tubes coming out of every orifice, I've got to treat this baby not just with love and with protection, but also with respect, because this is a human being like me, a human being loved and special. In fact, even more amazing, I've got to treat this baby with the same kind of wonder that Mary and Joseph treated their little bundle in a stable 2,000 years ago. Because Jesus was a baby, all babies are special. So the Christian understanding gives motivation for carers, both professional carers like me, but also, you know, the person who's getting up in the middle of the night to look after their incontinent mother and to change the bed sheets. Or what is it that motivates you? So one of the questions I sometimes ask people in debates is, I could offer you two hospitals, one where the staff are motivated by the ethics of Peter Singer, and another hospital where they're motivated by the ethics of Christianity. And which hospital would you wish to be admitted to when you are at the end of your life? Which hospital would you like your elderly mother to be admitted to? And it's interesting that a lot of people who would say, philosophically, I agree with Singer, actually, when it comes to healthcare, I'll choose the other hospital, please.
Yeah, we go back to the intuition one, don't we? Your final point, number seven, to correspond to Peter Singer's ethics, is the Christian view of humanity being made in the image of God provides a safeguard against the abusive and manipulative possibilities of advancing medical technologies. It kind of wraps up, to some degree, everything that we've been doing, in the sense that there are technologies that enable us to do so much now that we never even dreamt we could do, i.e. choose the gender of our child, or choose the eye colour of our child. That can be manipulative, destructive. Indeed, the ethics of Peter Singer, as you've outlined them, can indeed be interpreted as very, very destructive of humanity. This provides a safeguard.
Yes, so medical technology is bringing enormous benefits to humankind, and fundamentally, as Christian people, we can support it and see that in many ways we're uncovering the fundamental positive healing properties within the body. But technology has these two faces. It can always also be used in a profoundly negative way to take human life and to use a technical term, to instrumentalize it, to manipulate or abuse it. So that when we take a human embryo and tear it apart in order to get the bits that are going to be used in some kind of treatment. Or, for instance, taking, as now starting to happen, we can take the brains out of an aborted fetus and take out the bits and use this to treat Parkinson's disease in adults.
Mm.
So when we're doing that, we are in some way instrumentalizing, abusing, it seems to me, human life. Singer would say, well, what's wrong with it? I mean, the fetus is aborted, it's unwanted. If we take that bit of brain tissue and put it into someone struggling with Parkinson's disease, we're going to bring more happiness into the world. What could possibly be wrong with that? Christianity says, well, human life is special. Human beings are not to be abused and manipulated for the good of another human being. Every human life is special and to be protected.
John, it's just been fascinating to talk to you, to explore this notion of the Judeo-Christian ethic that can actually be the foundation of which we make medical decisions out of, and especially to contrast it with, you know, a radical ethicist like Peter Singer. It's just been fascinating to talk about. Last question. We've talked about the fact that in many ways your country, our country, Australia, the UK, America, etc., have been built on the Judeo-Christian ethic from the ground up. These days, because of pluralism, multiculturalism, etc., we're starting to say, okay, should other voices have a say in that? Understandably, that's a very important debate that we can actually have. And yet, as you were mentioning before, sometimes there's a sidelining of quote-unquote religious views, i.e. the Christian view, from the debate. And yet, as you said, there's an intuitive, at the very least, there's an intuitive grasp that if we want a hospital that is run under the ethics of Peter Singer, or versus the hospital that's run under the Christian ethic, we'll choose the Christian ethic. How can the Judeo-Christian ethic find a foothold again in the popular medical bioethical arena?
Yeah, it's a big question, and I don't have an easy answer. And I think there's been a big tendency for Christians to withdraw into a ghetto. These issues are all too complicated, too threatening, too difficult. It's much safer just to withdraw into our Christian ghetto, where we talk Christian language, where we sing Christian hymns, where we encourage one another. I think our calling, however, is to be salt and light, is to engage with the issues. And these are not straightforward issues. There are very complicated and multifaceted things. But fundamentally, it seems to me there are three sets of arguments that we can use in the public domain. We can use arguments that are based on the truth, that Christian understanding of reality actually hangs together, it's coherent, it's intellectually defensible. The problem with arguments based on truth is that in a postmodern world, you know, they often sort of go around in circles. Well, it's true for you and it's not true for me, and what is truth anyway, and how do I know it's true, and so on. Mm-hmm. And many Christians get discouraged at that point, but it seems to me there are other arguments we can make. The second group of arguments are because it works. There is empirical evidence that if you follow this particular pattern of moral behavior, it leads to positive outcomes. And therefore, as Christians, we need to look for the evidence that shows, that supports, and there is evidence out there to support a fundamental Christian understanding of human relationships, of human ethics, and so on. So because it's true, because it works. But finally, and we've already referred to it, this argument's based on intuitions, because it feels right. And paradoxically, in my experience, that's often some of the most effective arguments, theologically, intellectually, arguments based on intuition are always slightly dodgy because intuitions are not foolproof. But interestingly, in our modern world, it seems to me that often people's intuitions are more reliable than their actual thinking processes. And therefore, we can find arguments that, and the sort of arguments I've put forward are the sort of arguments I think which you can engage in a public debate and with secular people who are coming from a very different position. It is possible to be salt and light in this very complex and demanding arena.
Well, John, I hope that's given people just a taste of what you're going to do Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday at the New College Lectures. I'm certainly very inspired by what you've shared. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Medical ethicist John Wyatt there, who will be delivering the New College Lectures this Tuesday to Thursday on the topic Bioethics and Future Hope. If you're in Sydney, I hope you get there. If you're in Melbourne, I hope you'll fly there. If you're in another city, I hope you'll think very seriously about coming and being a part of it. newcollege.unsw.edu.au is the website to find out more. newcollege.unsw.edu.au.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.